Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios, a joint effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and the FAA Safety Team, the FAST Team. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Amy Loboda, editor of Aviation for Women magazine and FAST Team representative, Fort Myers, Florida, who is today's host.
Welcome to FAA's Managing Safety Podcast. I am Amy Loboda, your host, and I have here with me Captain Dick E. Norman on the board of directors of Norman Studio Silent Film Museum in Jacksonville, Florida. Captain Norman is the son of silent filmmaker Richard Norman and an aviation consultant, as well as an FAA aviation safety counselor whose career was inspired by his father's famous film, The Flying Ace. Welcome to the show, Dick. How are you today?
Just fine. Thank you very much, Amy.
Let's go all the way back to the very beginning of Hollywood films. I mean, your father really was right there at the beginning, and filmmaking and aviation kind of grew up together. Tell me a little bit about how that film, The Flying Ace, came to be.
Well, it came through his interest in my father. He's interested in flying also and many other things, but especially the scenario that he wrote for The Flying Ace was very, very interesting. The use of the actors at that time, of course, was a little bit different than most of the movies because he used all black cast. And they were all trained actors. Some of them came in from the New York area and some were handled locally there in the state of Florida in Jacksonville. That airplane, if I remember, of course, that was knee-high to grasshopper back in those ages. It's something that I saw and was very enthused about. He used a model of a DH-9 Able day bomber, which is a British aircraft, using a Liberty engine, and it's the one that he used in the movie. Of course, it was a model that was constructed to follow all the specs of that particular airplane and was used in the movie. He enjoyed very much flying himself, although he didn't do the flying, but he enjoyed it so much, and he decided to make this very interesting Flying Ace movie with the actors. And I myself, as a small child, later, not exactly at that time that that was made, was able to get in and maneuver that model around, and I enjoyed it so much. I just had friends of mine that came over and played with me, and that infused me in the aviation end, and from that on made my career throughout my life.
I'll tell you what year was it that The Flying Ace was made?
1928.
It was a fine year. What, you know, when you look back on it now, you say it was absolutely formative to what you decided to do next, but it was also formative to a whole bunch of people.
Absolutely.
You know, it was a critical time for aviation. Jimmy Doolittle was just learning to fly instruments with the Sperry Instrument Company. I mean, changes were coming down the pike. When did you finally take your very first airplane ride?
Oh, my very first airplane ride came a number of years later, and it was locally at the Amazon Airport in Jacksonville, Florida. And from that point on, I joined Mr. Young, Roy Young's operation there, which he was had a flying school there, and it was in the early 1940s.
What airplanes were you flying?
The first one I flew was a Piper Cub, of course. Absolutely. Piper Cub was the first one, and then I moved into some of the other aircraft. And a little later on, as my time progressed and I graduated from the high school area, I moved into the Air Force Aviation Cadet Program. And went through the military then and flew the PT-17s and AT-6s and so on and graduated as a B-25 pilot.
A B-25 pilot. What year was that?
1943.
How much B-25 flying did you do?
I guess I did about 150, 200 hours of B-25 flying.
Wow. In Europe or Asia?
Beg your pardon?
It, where, what theater did you fly
Oh,
in?
I was assigned to go to the European one, Asia, and at the time, that canceled out. In fact, I had a crew all ready to go completely with the new B-25Js, and they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and it stopped that, so we just didn't go. I assisted a lot in instructing in the B-25 for a while before we got our crew together, and that Billy Mitchell aircraft was a performing machine. I really enjoyed flying it.
Yeah, it's a fine, fine machine. That's absolutely true. After the war, what did you transition to next?
Well, after the war, I transitioned into quite a bit of local flying and at Jacksonville, and along with, again, with Mr. Laura Young and his operation at the Emerson Airport. And then one day he said, "Nick, you know, wouldn't you like it with an airline?" I said, "Yes, I certainly would. Yes, sir." He says, "Well, I have a good friend with National Airlines down in Miami. I'll give him a call." And he says, "You got your 4 and 5s from the Air Force and the flight, all the flight flying time that you've had, and I know about it. I know you've got a commercial license." I said, "That's correct." He said, so he called and talked to Lou Diamond, Mr. Diamond, National Airlines down in 1951 in Miami, and I was given a pass on a Roadstar aircraft the next Friday. I went down to interview and was hired next 2 weeks after that and stayed with National Airlines all the way through the program that they had as a National Airlines and then slowly into Pan American and retired in 1984. So I had a good 34 years of flying with total flying time of, I believe my total time, including all the military and everything else, was 22,788 hours.
Well, that's nothing to sneeze at. And there was some really great flying that you got to do. With National, probably more domestic. With Pan American, did you get to do some international flying?
Oh, yes, I did international flying, quite a bit of that, too. Yes, I enjoyed local flying in the United States much more than I did the international. And the reason for that is I got to take off and land a lot.
Yes.
Pan Am, you take off in New York and you land in London, period, you know.
That is absolutely true.
That was kind of boring to me.
You got a lot more practice. The other thing you got is you got to fly some machines with a three-person crew, where a lot of people these days it's just two people and the computers.
Absolutely.
And what do you think is the benefit of having that third person in the cockpit?
Oh, it's absolutely, I think, mandatory. You want me to say it? And I'll just emphasize that, mandatory to have that third man in there. We had so much safer operation. First of all, we got 6 eyes in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. Now we only have 4 eyes, and most of them are glued in on the equipment in there rather than looking out and seeing what's going on. And that is something that has always bothered me, that there's not enough attention to your flight status. You've got too much worry about the technical end of the airplane. One of the things here that I'd like to say right now, a note here that I've made. Let's see. Obie and I, yeah. Together, everybody achieves a mission. That's Obie's idea. Team, as you know. Together, everybody achieves a mission. And that's so, so excellent. Here's a little note I want to read to you that I wrote way back a number of years ago. We recently received a letter from our acting FAA administrator, Linda Hall Dosh. This letter made reference to the loss of life from the November 20, 1996 collision between an air carrier and general aviation aircraft at Quincy, Illinois. This gives us all good reason to renew our see and avoid vigilance when operating at non-towered airports. Mm-hmm. Tallahassee Regional Airport here in Tallahassee is an excellent tower and approach control airport, a full service complex serving our state capital with excellent radar control. We have a number of uncontrolled satellite airports in our area. Remember the 70-30 rule, 70% out and 30% in your cockpit. Use your radio at these airports. It may look as if you have the airspace to yourself, but short radio traffic can be surprised with the most vigilant pilot. In other words, as a suggestion, use the block system, and I call it the block system, because mm-hmm. a visual scan, a block is 10 to 15 degrees wide. Start at the far left and make a methodical sweep to the right, pausing at each block to focus. at the end of the scan, then return to the flight panel. Remember, the slower your plane, the greater your vulnerability. Hence, the greater scan error is required. Now, that's what I'm talking about, being able to see outside. And when you have an engineer on board working on the technical parts of the airplane, you can fly the airplane and look outside the same side. So I thought it was real mandatory to keep this engineer because the system changed over. They did not do it.
Now, well, let's we're going to continue that conversation here in just a minute. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break with FAA's Managing Safety Podcast.
Now, let's rejoin Amy Lavoda and Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios.
Welcome back to FAA's Managing Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Amy Lavoda, the Editor-in-Chief of Aviation for Women magazine, and I have here with me today Captain Dick Norman. He is on the Board of Directors of Norman Studio Silent Film Museum in Jacksonville, Florida. He is also a highly experienced retired airline captain, retired from Pan American World Airways in 1984, and we were just talking about that third-person syndrome in the cockpit and how valuable that extra set of eyes can be. But I want to talk a little bit more about what happens between the two ears in the cockpit. Actually, that third person gives you a third brain and a third whole processing system, if you want to think about CPU and brain power. And there's something to that. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I totally agree to that. Absolutely. With all three people in there, that you have three brains in there, and all of them are operating brains, which are experienced and also have questions and answers, each of them. And I think that is so important, very important. I'm awful sorry that the industry has changed over this other way, and I assume they've changed over because of cost factors.
Yeah.
Even though they have the equipment on the airplanes that's redundant, they have to have redundancy there, you still lose the brain power, and you just spoke of brain power, and you're correct.
Yeah, computers don't, they don't have intuition. They don't have the same kind of, like you said, thought processes to reason through what's going on here. They're certainly
Absolutely.
Good at monitoring systems. In fact, they're probably better at just plain old monitoring than the human brain on a certain level, because computers don't get bored. But it's that human factor in an emergency that we've seen play out and look at things and make quick decisions and be able to really make the difference. So I think you're probably like me. Now, I know you are an FAA FAST team member, just like I am, in Florida. We both work very, very hard for the same person, Obi Young, the safety program manager for the Orlando FISDO. And we have certainly seen our share in the last 30 years or so, and you, going back even farther than that, of times when that human being in the cockpit made the difference between an incident and an accident where there were no fatalities and an accident where there could have been, you know, tremendous fatalities.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So one of the things that we like to talk about on this show is why things such as redundancy and recurrent training make such a difference to pilots. Now, you come out of an airline background. I come out of a general aviation background. But would you not agree with me that standardization and recurrent training is what keeps things safe for people?
Absolutely, it is. And the WINGS program that's in progress, and so much things, problems that they come up with, they say it's stumbling. They're not stumbling. I think the WINGS program is excellent. And as my approach, of course, to it is, you know, the airlines, I had a six-month check every 6 months. We went in and reviewed. We went in and practiced. We did our emergency procedures. We went through one right after the other, which brought us up to a level that we should be, a safe level we should be in flying commercial aircraft. And I think the WINGS program is excellent. And it's one of the things that general aviation, we should move more towards wings, maybe changing a few of the areas in there, but not too much, because I believe all of them should be brought up to speed and able to follow their regulations as they're supposed to in a safe way. And my approach to the flying level is that you need review no less than every 6 months to keep you up to speed in all the safety aspects that are required. And there's changes that are coming left and right now all the time. General aviation people, it's kind of a hard thing. I understand this. Cost factors are involved and everything else. But if you're going to be a proficient pilot, you should be contained totally in the wings program. I went through the complete wings program when it started out and went to level 10 with no problem. Since then I have retired. Of course, I'm supporting the wings program in all things we're doing and following through with our local people here, not only locally here in Tallahassee, but in our satellite airports and around this area here, and working with OBI. So my approach to it is that every 6 months we should have a review, absolutely.
I agree with you. First of all, I love my pins, which is one of the nice things that you can get courtesy of Avemco, is an absolutely wonderful lapel pin that shows that you're a participant in the wings program. But from a flight instructor's viewpoint, I think that the fact that the wings program keeps you flying, you know, there's three flights involved for every three lessons that you do the ground training. And the wonderful thing is that ground training is all integrated, it's all online, and it's free now.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
you really, there's no excuse not to do it. And I just recently had a cross country where I had to go very close to the Washington, D.C. area. And let me tell you, that's some complex airspace. And
absolutely.
I went back, and though I'd already done the Washington, D.C. ADIZ training program and gotten my certificate, which is required if you want to fly in that area.
Right, absolutely.
I went back and I reviewed that one more time, and it really increased my comfort level and my knowledge as I navigated that airspace, that I knew that I wasn't going to be in a problem area. I wasn't going to have to deal with an unintended incursion into the airspace. And let me tell you, that creates a comfort factor. And
well, certainly
that's
a comfort
a good
factor.
Thing. That's
it's a safety factor. It's required. I'll put it that way, period.
Yeah, it's required, and it doesn't hurt to go back and look it over every now and again. The nice thing about the wings is, again, you know, that part of it doesn't cost you anything but a little time. And
right.
If you're really interested in flying and you're into it, how can you not give it a little time on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday evening? You know,
right,
relaxed,
absolutely.
Out of the comfort of your easy chair, sitting with your laptop. I mean, they couldn't make it any easier than that.
Right.
Yes, most definitely. Well, let's talk one more time a little bit about Norman Studios. The Silent Film Museum is something that has really been a project of yours for how long?
Oh, it's been quite a long time, the project has, and I'm staring at a good 30 years, and I'm so enthused with the fact that we have some very interesting historians that are locally around the Norman Studio area in Arlington, which is Arlington in the section of Jacksonville, and they wanted to preserve this and move in that direction politically, and pretty soon the city and the state of Florida also decided to purchase the property, which they did. And now it's up and will be put up very soon, here, as soon as we finish the renovation for a historical enjoyment for tourists as they come through. Now, my father was a pretty good gentleman. He not only had the scenarios and wrote the scripts, but he was the cameraman and handled setting the scenes up and everything else. He, of course, had help and employees, but he was the top of the line. Mr. Jack Warner of Warner Brothers Studios in Hollywood, and I can remember him telling me this years ago, wanted him to come out there and be a director with Hollywood, and he wouldn't do it because he was so interested in doing his own work and doing what he had to do with the back cast that he had, which was really surprising at that time. The back cast were so very good. And it was also one other thing, if you want to go into the racial end of it, is bringing up the ability of what these black people can do and could do at that time, and also the entertainment that they provided through the silent movies. So the movies that he made were extraordinary. We had a number of the prints that I had that I donated to the archives in Washington, D.C. They have them now. And quite a few of them were able to maintain themselves, although some of the film strips became cancerous because they began to dissolve. But The Flying Ace is one that's kept completely now and does have it. And when we finish the renovation and completion of the property there in Arlington, the Norman Studios, we're going to be running the Flying Ace as an attraction to tourists as they come through.
Excellent. And that's a five-building silent film studio complex.
Yes.
It's in the old Arlington neighborhood of Jacksonville. And if people want more information, they can go to www.normanstudios.org on the internet and find out where and how and when they can get to see this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Dick, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Captain Dick Norman of Norman Studios Silent Film Museum in Jacksonville, Florida, for joining us on Managing Safety today. Again, stay safe out there.
Thank you very much, Ms. LaBona. It's a great pleasure to do this.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios, a joint effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and the FAA Safety Team. Please visit our studio website at faaproductionstudios.com to hear past programs.